We're talking about Republican lawmakers writing the next state budget and the plans for K-12 and higher ed funding. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The powerful 16-member Joint Finance Committee, it met in executive session yesterday to debate and vote on education funding for Wisconsin schools. They directed an extra $128 million in general purpose revenue for K-12 schools, but it's a far cry from Governor Evers' $1.6 billion increase that he called for in his budget plan. What do you think of the K-12 budget votes? 800-642-1234. Greta Neubauer is a Democratic state representative from Racine. She's a member of the legislature's Joint Finance Committee. Representative Neubauer, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
So what are your biggest concerns coming out of yesterday and the plan from Joint Finance Committee on K-12 funding?
As they say, a budget is a moral document. And despite what legislators say on the campaign trail, a budget votes are where priorities are made clear. And Republican legislators failed the kids of Wisconsin yesterday. The K-12 budget included just 10% of what Governor Evers proposed. The UW system budget included none of the increases in general aids, instead squirreling money away to perhaps maybe be approved in the future. And maybe most importantly, Republican legislators put our receipt of federal American Rescue Plan dollars in jeopardy, as they did not meet a requirement yesterday for what's called maintenance of effort towards education funding. You know, they say that maybe we will see them transfer future money to K-12 schools and higher ed, but maybe we won't, which again puts that $1.5 billion from the American Rescue Plan that's intended to go towards our K-12 schools and higher ed in jeopardy.
Before we get into the rescue plan and how it parlays into this budget, are there any aspects of this plan that you do support?
There is some money that is going towards student mental health. There are a number of programs that the governor proposed that will receive some funding from Republicans, but it's nowhere near what the kids of Wisconsin need. It's nowhere near what they asked us for over the course of our hearings around the state and public testimony. We're very grateful to be able to receive American Rescue Plan dollars, but we cannot build our long-term budgets based off of one-time funds. And it's very clear that the people of Wisconsin want more investment in our public schools and our technical colleges and UW system. And Republicans just are not meeting the demand.
When you look at the COVID relief dollars, Republican committee co-chair Senator Howard Markline of Spring Green, he downplayed concerns over qualifying for the federal relief dollars. Here's part of his comments at the meeting yesterday.
You can be as dramatic as you want to be. I don't believe the risk is, I'm aware of the risk. We've considered it. We'll talk about it as we go through, but I think the risk is manageable.
So if the state's education funding falls short of qualifying, what happens? Couldn't the state get a federal waiver or move funding from one pot of money to another?
So that is possible. Just for background, right, what the federal government required, both through the CARES Act and then added on to it with the American Rescue Plan, is that the states, the proportion of state spending allocated to K-12 and higher ed in 21 to 22 and then 22 to 23 must be maintained at the same level as the state's average allocation in 16-17, 17-18, and 18-19. And again, that is a condition of receiving those funds that are intended to go towards our schools. What the Republicans did yesterday is they put $350 million, which would be enough to meet that maintenance of effort, into the budget stabilization fund, saying this is intended to go towards K-12. However, there's no guarantee that that money will actually be voted on. It would need to go through the full legislature. Many of the members of the legislature said they don't want those ARPA funds to come to our state on the Republican side. And so I have real concerns that that money won't actually be moved and that we will be out of compliance. Now, we could theoretically apply for this federal waiver, but we don't know if we would receive it. And that is not acceptable when we're talking about $1.5 billion that our schools are depending on to bounce back from this pandemic.
We're discussing yesterday's state budget action on K-12 schools. We have Democratic State Representative Greta Neubauer from Racine, member of the State Budget Writing Committee. You can join in. What do you think of Democrats and Republican state budget proposals for K-12 schools? Where should it go from here? What are your top funding concerns for K-12? 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@WPR.org. You know, Republicans argued the need for a state-funded increase isn't so great because you do have this funding, this federal dollars from the American Rescue Plan Act. You know, do they have a point here?
What we heard when we traveled around the state, Whitewater, Rhinelander, Menominee, you know, the thousands of public comments that people submitted throughout this process, is that they want to see a long-term investment in their schools. Their kids are not getting the support they need. I have spoken to countless parents over the last year whose children were having mental health crises, and they had nowhere to go. There were no resources available for them. The funds that we are allocating towards K-12, towards higher ed, are just not cutting it. We heard from advocates over and over about the need to make sure that we are meeting the special ed reimbursement rate of 45 and 50%, so that school districts can meet those needs of special ed students and meet the needs of their other students.
And just a caveat here, Republicans want a smaller increase to 30% for, reimbursement rates for special ed. Is that right?
That's right. They are prorating. They're hoping to get to 30%. This is what they did last budget as well. The governor alternatively said, we are going to meet 45 and 50%. And again, we're just missing the mark.
So when you look at this budget, you talk about mental health. Republicans and Democrats seem to agree on the need to increase funding for school mental health. The difference may be exactly how much. Here is Republican Joint Finance Co-Chair Mark Bourne at a news conference before yesterday's meeting.
We will see new challenges in mental health in our schools because of the fact that so many of these schools were closed and the challenges that that puts on kids. And so I think these are issues that we need to address. We need to help the kids transition back into schools as they reopen and help them with these new mental health needs that have been identified. So we think it's a priority to invest in these programs and help them transition back into schools and get back into learning.
Where did the Joint Finance Committee land on mental health funding?
So the governor proposed $46.5 million in school mental health aides, and Republicans put forward, again, just a fraction of that. It is really challenging when we, again, have kids in our schools who are expressing the desire, the need to receive support, and there is none for them. The proposal the Republicans put forward is just not going to meet the need that's been identified in our state. And it's really disheartening. The Wisconsin Public Education Network tallied up the comments over the course of our in-person public hearings, and they said that about 50%, just under 50% of people were there, testified on public education. You know, this need has been so clearly identified. And Republicans' motion increased spending overall by just about 1% for K-12 yesterday. And it is not being responsive to what the people of Wisconsin have asked us to do.
Greta Neubauer with us, Democratic State Representative from Racine, a member of the legislature's Budget Writing Committee. Parents and teachers, let's hear from you. How is your school doing financially? What are its pressing needs? What do you think of Republicans' spending plan for schools over the next 2 years? Join in 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Representative Neubauer here on the Ideas Network. We are digging into the Republican spending plan for Wisconsin schools over the next 2 years. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Republicans on the Budget Writing Committee voted to lift a UW tuition freeze on undergrad students that's been in place for 8 years. Separately, the Budget Writing Committee voted along party lines to reward school districts that haven't been holding classes virtually in the past year. So what do you make of that? What do you think of dividing up some federal relief funds based on how much in-person teaching a district does? What is the right formula for special ed cost reimbursements and per-pupil aid? What do you see there? 800-642-1234. State Representative Greta Neubauer is a Democratic member of the legislature's Joint Finance Committee. She stays with us. Sean is joining us from Madison. Sean, I understand you are a special education teacher.
I am. And I have seen such a growing need for support for not just special education students, but regular education students as well. I'd like to say people with extra needs, not special needs, but I've been in this business for over 15 years as far as helping people at a nonprofit and then now in public schools teaching. And, you know, I am, again, as I said to your the person that takes the calls, I am not Democrat. I am not Republican. I have voted both ways. But it's been very disheartening to see that in the state of Wisconsin, Republicans are seemingly, disheartening, that they purposely, it seems, go against Democrat views. And I'm not a Democrat. I am not a Republican. I want to just say that. But we have public referendums, and when people speak and they vote a certain way, they don't care. It's weird to say that. Mark Bourne is a very good person. I do know him personally, and I know that he knows this situation. So I think you said that they voted to increase just by like a few percent the reimbursement. When special education is just a burgeoning cost on the school districts, it's just, I don't know what their thinking is, if it's just a political move or if they're really thinking about the people. So I'll stop there.
Yeah, Sean, thank you so much for bringing that perspective and for teaching. Representative Neubauer, is partisan politics compromising the kids?
Absolutely. I think that yesterday showed that, unfortunately, Republican legislators are more focused on sticking it to Governor Evers than they are on keeping their promises to the students of their district, who, again, no matter where they're from, need more funding for special education, urban, rural, suburban. We heard from folks all over the state throughout this process, and they are asking us to increase the special education reimbursement rate.
Well, let me ask you this. When Governor Evers ran for governor, he vowed to increase school funding so that the state paid for 2/3 of public school costs, what we often refer to as 2/3 funding for education. Where does this spending plan put us on that particular formula?
Oh, we are not there. The Republican motion came out yesterday. You know, it's 2 pages, notably absent the commitment to 2/3 funding, increasing general aid per pupil. There was so much that Republicans didn't even consider yesterday. And I think that, you know, as Sean mentioned, there's just no way to explain it other than the desire to stick it to the governor, because it's just not what Republican legislators are hearing from their districts.
What do you make under the plan? About $115 million or so would be distributed only to districts that were open for in-person instruction for at least half of the school year. What do you make of that?
So the vast majority of funds distributed under SRR are distributed based on a federal formula, which means that luckily state Republicans can't mess with them. The remaining percentage of the funds goes to the Joint Finance Committee. And, you know, I think what I found most telling yesterday was that Republicans spoke at great length about the concerns that they have about students who are virtual, you know, the concerns they have about the learning disruption. But then they went ahead and passed a motion that penalized those students, right? They may say this is rewarding the districts that, you know, made the choice to be in person, but the reality is that it's penalizing the students who were virtual, whose districts made that choice because it was the safe thing for them to do at the time. So I think it's really unfortunate that Republicans are taking this approach to funding for our kids.
We're discussing yesterday's state budget action on K-12 schools. We'll get to higher ed in a moment. We have Democratic State Representative Greta Neubauer on the line from Racine, sits on Joint Finance Committee. You can join in with your thoughts. Does your child attend a public school, a charter school, a private school? What do you feel about state aid and what is being sought in the next budget? 800-642-1234. Part of the Republican plan, Representative Neubauer, would include transferring that $350 million to the state's rainy day fund, as you mentioned earlier. Here is Republican Senator Dewey Strobel from Sockville during yesterday's committee hearing.
We're going to use these federal resources, and we're going to prepare to have a smooth transition to the next budget when those aren't available. And I believe this money setting aside does that.
Do you agree it is prudent to put aside this money for possible future uses?
We need to spend this money. The American Rescue Plan actually stipulates that the money needs to be expended on education in our state for us to qualify for those funds. So we are putting $1.5 billion of American Rescue Plan funds at risk with this move. You know, the legislature has not always shown itself to be the most prudent in accepting federal dollars and spending them on things that Wisconsinites really want, like the Medicaid expansion. The Joint Finance Committee itself has money, millions of dollars still squirreled away that were supposed to be approved for homelessness. I'm very concerned that the legislature will not move forward, will not approve that money, and it will, again, put those dollars in jeopardy that our schools are now counting on that they need to recover from the pandemic.
Let's move on to UW tuition to higher ed here. Joint Finance left open the possibility of increasing tuition at UW system schools by not continuing the freeze that was started under Governor Walker. Is it time to end the freeze?
The challenge here is that Governor Evers' budget, both kept the freeze and it funded the freeze, which meant that our UW system schools would get the funding that they need to maintain a really high quality of education for students. Instead, what Republicans have done is say, you know what, we don't want to deal with this problem. We don't want to be responsible for UW tuition and just kick the can down the road. So It's really tough. You know, it's again indicative of their priorities, indicative of their values, that they are not willing to increase investment in a significant way to Wisconsin Technical College and UW system, which is an incredible investment for us, always 23-1, right, in the UW system, but especially as we look to recover from the pandemic.
So Joint Finance approves $8 million increase for UW system, $9 million increase for the state's technical colleges. Is that enough, do you think?
Well, it is not enough for us to meet, again, the maintenance of effort to receive those federal funds. And it is just not what we heard from the many students who showed up and spoke to us. We had in-person hearings at a number of UW campuses. And students talked about the needs they have, professors, staff, the deferred maintenance over many years, the cuts to salaries, right? If we want to maintain the UW system as a world-class educational system, we need to make additional investments. And the governor's proposal had a plan. It had a plan, but unfortunately Republicans have once again chosen partisanship over their constituents.
I want to get back here in the last few moments to what Sean in Madison was referencing a bit. you know, what is the working relationship of Joint Finance Committee and the members of this committee as you try to put a budget together? What is it like sitting on it?
Well, for those who tuned in yesterday, you heard our Republican colleagues say that we were being dramatic, that, you know, the schools in their districts were just fine, and that from their perspective, these investments were enough. And I think I sit there in those moments and think about the kids who I talk to, the schools that I visited before the pandemic, and the very real needs and the reality that we are failing our kids in this state due to our lack of investment. So it's a challenge. We continue the work. We will continue to do our best over the process. But the relationships are tense. I'll leave it at that.
Representative Neubauer, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Greta Neubauer, Democratic State Representative from Racine. We'll be back after a news update on the Ideas Network. Here with us for the morning show, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Maureen McCollum with the story of Captain Franklin Van Valkenburgh, just ahead of Memorial Day. The captain's remembrance was written by longtime Milwaukee Journal Sentinel reporter Meg Jones. Meg tragically passed away from cancer in December and spent much of her career covering Wisconsin veterans and service members.
Memorial Day is Monday, and today we're going to reflect on the life of one fallen soldier. Meg Jones tells us about the Milwaukee-born captain of the USS Arizona at Pearl Harbor.
Franklin Van Valkenburgh spent his entire adult life training for war. And when that day came, Van Valkenburgh would be among the first to die. He grew up in Milwaukee, son of a prominent lawyer, and when he left for the U.S. Naval Academy in 1905, Van Valkenburgh never really came home again. He moved up through the ranks, serving on many vessels ranging from battleships to submarine tenders. In February 1941, Van Valkenburgh was assigned to what would turn out to be his last posting, the USS Arizona at Pearl Harbor. It was Van Valkenburgh's cruel fate to spend decades training for combat and die just 11 minutes into his first battle. It's true that America was caught by surprise when the Japanese attacked, but it's also true that the U.S. military was wary of Japanese aggression in the Pacific. That's why Navy commanders moved the Arizona and the rest of its fleet from the West Coast to Pearl Harbor. Like the other ship captains stationed at Pearl, Van Valkenburgh repeatedly trained his sailors and Marines for battle. In a letter to his aunt 1 month before the Japanese attack, he wrote about the long hours he spent on the Arizona's bridge putting his men through their paces. "We never go to sea," he wrote, "without being completely ready to move on to Singapore if need be. Our eyes are constantly trained westward, and we keep the guns ready for instant use against aircraft or submarines whenever we are at sea. We have no intention of being caught napping." That's just what happened, though. A Japanese attack not at sea, but while most of America's Navy was in port. The USS Arizona's band was on deck preparing to play the national anthem for the morning flag raising when the first torpedo bombers with rising sun emblems began to drop out of the sky. They swarmed like hornets over Battleship Row, dropping torpedoes that streaked through the water, blowing holes in ships where sailors were sleeping, eating breakfast, and getting ready for shore leave.
"We interrupt this program to bring you a special news bulletin. The Japanese have attacked Pearl Harbor, Hawaii, by air."
When the Arizona's air raid alarm sounded at 7:55 a.m., Van Valkenburgh was seen sprinting to the one place a ship's captain needed to be, the bridge. As he emerged from the conning tower, Van Valkenburgh was hit by shrapnel that tore into his abdomen. He must have been in intense pain, but he refused to be carried to safety. Instead, he stayed at his post, directing the defense of his ship. Torpedoes rocked the Arizona, but the death blow came from a bomb that penetrated the deck and ignited the ship's forward ammunition compartment. Witnesses said it looked as if the Arizona leaped out of the water. A grainy color film shows a bolt of flame and black smoke blowing sky high as the ship exploded. It would become the iconic image of America's first minutes of World War II. It was 8:06 a.m. Van Valkenburgh's body was never found. Only his Naval Academy class ring and two uniform buttons were recovered. He was posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor, and to this day, he's officially listed as missing in action. His name is on the large white wall at the USS Arizona Memorial, along with the 1,176 men under his command who died at Pearl Harbor. Perhaps most fitting for a man who spent his entire life in service, his name is not at the top of the list of Arizona casualties. It's actually toward the bottom because the list is alphabetical. I think Franklin Van Valkenburg would have wanted it that way.
Meg Jones is a reporter with the Milwaukee Journal Sentinel and author of the book World War II Milwaukee. She brought us the story of Captain Franklin Van Valkenburg. He was one of 56 Wisconsinites to die at the attack at Pearl Harbor. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Maureen McCollum.
And now to the unprecedented demands on nursing staff that's having a huge impact on mental well-being. According to the American Psychiatric Nurses Association, nurses make up a bulk of the healthcare workforce, and they're experiencing pressure, fear, exhaustion, isolation, and ongoing emotional trauma. Are you a nurse or on the healthcare team? Do you work in the COVID unit? How is your mental health? How is quality of life on the job? 800-642-1234 to join in. Heather Shimmers is Chief Nursing Officer for Ascension, Wisconsin, where she leads more than 6,000 nursing professionals at 24 hospitals, over 100 clinics. Heather, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Good morning, Kate. Thank you so much for having me.
Good morning. Last time we talked with you, it was the holiday season. Your patient census was incredibly high. You had very limited, tight capacity in your ICU. Can you give us a snapshot of how things are going inside your hospitals now?
I'm sure I'd be happy to. You're right. The atmosphere has definitely changed since the last time I was able to speak with you all. We were in the midst of a horrible surge at that time. And I will tell you, with our declining numbers in Wisconsin, we are also seeing declining hospital admissions. So that is good news. They are still there. However, our ICUs continue to be busy. But what we're seeing now is an increase in acuity of patients who perhaps have foregone some of the care that they needed to during the COVID just because of some fear.
Mm. Yeah. So you're certainly seeing that as well. But how has the decline in hospitalizations, has it reduced the strain on your healthcare facilities, on your staffing, and how you go about this?
You know, that's an interesting question. And I will tell you that it hasn't, because it hasn't really stopped. So we're still in the pandemic. We're still living with this. Volumes remain fairly consistent. So our nurses really haven't been able to take a break. And I think I used the analogy last time I was here about calling our nurses superheroes. And, you know, to me, a superhero gets to go home and take their costume off and take their cape, hang their cape up every once in a while. And Our nurses haven't had that opportunity yet. They, you know, healthcare is a 24/7 business. We haven't been able to really stop and just take a breath yet.
How are you giving them breaks? How are you working to address the stress, the burnout?
Yeah. So if it's okay with you, Kate, I'd love to just share a few stats with you.
Please.
About nursing and kind of where we're at, just to kind of set the tone. So as we move forward, you'll understand why we're doing what we're doing. So from the Bureau of Labor Statistics, we know that we are going to experience a shortfall of nearly 510,000 RNs by the year 2030. And 2030, sometimes when I say that, seems like that's a really far, far way out in the future, but it's not. But we also know with that same stat that we have a growing demand for nurses, and we're going to need an additional 200,000 RNs a year to keep up with current demands. I also can tell you that 21% of all nurses have indicated that they would like to transfer to a non-patient care role at the end of this pandemic.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah. 10% of nurses are reporting that they want to leave the profession altogether. And right now for us, as we're continuing to need to fill positions, it's taking about 91 days to fill an open ICU position and 76 days to fill a med-surg position. That is a really long time to get those positions filled. So the the throughput of nurses coming into our system just has drastically declined. And this is probably the most staggering statistic that I want to share with you, is that RN burnout has grown absolutely as a result of the pandemic. And when we talk to nurses and we ask them if they're personally experiencing burnout, 94% of them are saying yes.
So when you look at these national statistics, you look at what's happening in your hospitals, and you know your nursing staff is burning out. They want to transfer. They want to do something different. How do you approach that administratively? How do you make this work?
Yeah, I'm excited to share some of the things we're doing. So I think those of us that are clinical leaders, we just need to continue to work together to really understand the impact of our changing practice environments and really look at the engagement and the morale of our nurses and how we can continue to improve. So as we do that, I'll tell you, this vision led to the implementation of what we're calling the Ascension Nursing Center of Excellence. It's a new model for providing clinically excellent, safe, compassionate, personalized care. And it's really designed to satisfy the needs of our nursing workforce while we just continue to respond and proactively prepare as the changing trends and expectations in healthcare continue to emerge. Which I just realized that not only do we need to transform the care for those that we're privileged to serve, we need to continually look at that quadruple aim around health outcomes and patient experience and provider experience, and then figure out how to do it at a very low cost. But we also, I think the most important thing that I'm realizing, and all nursing leaders across the country are realizing, is that we have to transform to meet the needs and expectations of our nurses and other caregivers. So I think as I say that to you, what we know is that I need to mitigate burnout and return joy to this nursing practice. And I think the best way to do that is to cultivate really a culture of clinical innovation, professional respect, team engagement and collaboration, make sure that our individuals are flourishing in their workplace community. So I think it's really working on making sure that our nurses on the front line have a voice in the work that they are actively being asked to deliver, anything that impacts their work. We're just continually working at developing new and innovative ways to ensure that happens. So there's lots of projects going on around that.
Yeah, but you know, how do you make that happen on the floor, return joy on the floor, when you have said, you know, COVID is a minute by minute disease? It is, you know, just this chess game to ensure you have the beds available, that it's very individualized. There's not a defined care plan because COVID affects people in all these different ways. How do you mitigate that, but also make the job less stressful for nurses?
Yeah, I'm not sure that there's any way to fully take the stress away. But I'll tell you a few of the tactical things that we've done to really help. And the way I like to describe some of the things we're doing is that we certainly are not asking any nursing professional to get rid of the burden that they're carrying on their shoulders through this COVID pandemic, but just to help them carry it a little bit more lightly. So one of the things that we're in the process of doing right now is partnering with our spiritual services teams, our mission leaders, our employee assistance professionals. And we're really offering what we're doing as a take on narrative medicine. And it's an opportunity for just our frontline nurses. So right now I have two groups running throughout Ascension, Wisconsin, and it's bringing like-minded nurses together to watch a video. It was a video shared by the New York Times, and it was filmed in a COVID unit. I'm not sure if you had the opportunity to see that, but it really does a beautiful job of capturing the emotions of the nurses that were caring for these patients during the height of a surge. So as the nurses watch this, we ask them to really watch it in a quiet space, take some time, write down your thoughts, and then we give them an opportunity to really share their feelings about the video together with other individuals that have experienced the same thing they have. Our goal is really just to give them a very safe place to share their story and realize that they're not alone in this journey. Again, I think it's an attempt to decrease the stigma in our profession and to forget that, that we just need to make sure that we're taking care of our caregivers' mental health.
Chief Nursing Officer at Ascension Wisconsin, Heather Shimmers, explaining the trauma, the stress of nursing through the pandemic. Are you in charge of a hospital or clinic? What do you do to ensure your staff are okay? What have you put in place? How do you monitor burnout and fatigue? Is a loved one on the front lines of healthcare? What have they told you about work stress and how they're coping? Still time, 800-642-1234. Back in a minute with Heather Shimmers here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Nurses are feeling the effects on their health, morale, their careers. We're learning what can be done to help nurses heal and recover from the pandemic. It's leaving many nurses stressed, burned out, even traumatized, according to recent polling and the research we've been talking about. Are you a nurse? What can you say about what you've been through? Help us understand. 800-642-1234. Heather Shimmers is Chief Nursing Officer at Ascension Wisconsin and stays with us for about 10 more minutes. Heather, how are you approaching at this point testing and screening your nursing staff for COVID?
So we're doing, you know, following the CDC and the Department of Health and Human Services guidance around that definitely has improved. I will tell you that our numbers of infected workforce are declining by the day, which is wonderful news. So we're continuing, you know, if there's symptomatic situations, we're continuing to follow the guidelines and make sure that we're keeping all individuals safe. We are still masking in all of our healthcare facilities, and we're screening every single associate and visitor that comes into our buildings.
Do you still have a lot of nursing staff out due to COVID?
I would tell you we're ranging, not a lot. We're ranging right now across Ascension, Wisconsin, with all of our associates between about 25 and 30 every day.
Let's bring in a call now. Amy is joining us in Beloit. Amy is an occupational therapist. Hi.
Hi. Hi. Thank you for taking my call. I'm an occupational therapist. I'm the occupational therapist for a home health department here in Beloit. And I just had a comment that, you know, when that these patients who have COVID illness go home. And a lot of times they are still incredibly ill. And we've had to go in and see them in their homes. And a lot of times some of those homes still have family members with active COVID infections. And it was a really terrifying experience at first, because we didn't know, there really aren't any clear protocols for how to enter a home with people who may or may not be masking or who don't have good, awareness of how to control the infection. And so our team, after we got over the initial shock, it was just kind of a matter of really turning to your team members when you had those opportunities to say, you know, this is insane. This is ridiculous. And so we kind of kept things like running jokes on the whiteboards and things that, just to let off a little bit of steam, because it was really an intense, situation that is still ongoing. And I guess one of my questions, is, you know, I keep hearing about the hospital at home movement, and I wonder if your guest has any comments on that, because I know part of that Triple Aim project is to basically decrease patients in beds in hospitals.
In care patients. Yeah, Amy, thank you so much for bringing your perspective and story. Heather, what do you see there?
Well, first of all, Amy, thank you so much. What a great question. And thank you also for everything you've done. I can only imagine some of the experiences that you've been through during all of this with caring for patients at home. And I think, kind of as I mentioned before, when you think about the acuity and the level of the illness that our inpatient associates have experienced, think about how we're sending patients home. So, Amy, I would guess that what you're seeing is a population of individuals who are far more ill than you've ever experienced before in your home health journey as a healthcare professional. So I will tell you, you are 100% right. Our landscape on where and how we're going to provide care has completely changed. And this momentum towards delivering care at home is a key strategy for us at Ascension, figuring out how to really transfer that workforce. With that being said, though, I think that's also a really exciting opportunity for our clinical workforce to experience care in different settings, which you heard me say one of those statistics is that they don't, you know, nurses are tired of the patient care roles at the bedside in the hospital setting. I think this is going to give us an opportunity to really develop a more flexible workforce and offer them opportunities to work outside of the hospital.
Amy, thanks so much. Alexander is with us from Appleton. Hi, Alexander. What is your story in nursing?
Hi, good morning. I was a former bedside nurse in cardiology and telemetry, and now I transitioned prior to the pandemic into data analytics and following our remote patient monitoring programs like Amy had just referenced. And I was experiencing large amounts of burnout prior to the pandemic and working in various travel nursing roles throughout the country. I've noticed that the amount of staffing and the compensation that nurses are given are constantly drives down the amount of burnout. I had the opportunity to serve as a resource nurse, just helping out other nurses around the unit. And it's just a very rewarding role. And one of our things that my current hospital is looking into is reallocating funds so that we can compensate our nurses and offer more competitive rates and benefit packages in order to safely staff our team. I was feeling completely compassion fatigued, but loved my job. And there's nothing worse than putting in all of your compassion and knowing that you don't have enough time to get everything done. So I just wonder if there's anything in Wisconsin that's being done to kind of drive nurses here and make it a better experience compared to other health systems.
Heather, go ahead.
So Tyler, thank you. And thank you for everything you do. I too am from Appleton. So I understand where you're working and what you're doing. So thank you for what you're doing. You are 100% correct in the fact that our economic landscape has changed, hasn't it? When you think about not only just the nursing profession, but think about those clinical support roles that are supporting nursing. You know, we're now competing with CNAs that can go out of the healthcare system and take a position at a Quick Trip or Costco and make equally, if not more money than what we've been able to offer for CNA so far. So we are 100% absolutely continually evaluating, you know, pay and the structure of pay for our clinical individuals in Wisconsin. The other thing I will tell you is it's more than that. And I love to hear you mention that you're a resource nurse. That's an innovative approach to staffing. And that's what we need to continue to do is figure out different ways. Really, when you think about nursing as a practice, we haven't really changed our model of care in about 20 years, right? We just haven't. So the more, Tyler, positions like the one you're serving in as a resource nurse, that we can continue to provide those opportunities to take some of that burden off of the frontline nurse to really be able to offer them time with their patients to provide the care and the hands-on care that they want to provide, that's what we need to just keep improving on. So I appreciate you bringing that up. Thank you so much.
Heather, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I always enjoy being here.
Heather Shimmers is Chief Nursing Officer for Ascension Wisconsin. Just ahead, we talk with Pride event organizers in Wisconsin about this year's events. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.